Hey, buddy.
How do you quantify?
Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is March 23rd, 2017. We've got a full agenda again, so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2961. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2961 establishes the Home Ownership Repair and Rehabilitation Program within the Housing and Community Services Department to provide grants to eligible nonprofit organizations to provide financial assistance to eligible low-income households for repair and rehabilitation of their residences. The bill specifies eligibility and agreement requirements for the nonprofit organizations to receive grants from OHCS and requires grant program recipients to report to OHCS regarding the status and use of the grant funds. The bill also establishes the Homeownership Repair and Rehabilitation Program Fund and continuously appropriates money to fund the program at OHCS. This bill becomes operative January 1st, 2018 and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017, and there is a sub-referral to Joint Ways and Means.
This is a fantastic bicameral bipartisan lineup.
Thank you. Now, this is Brad's with Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing before you this morning in support of House Bill 2961. And I just want to say that my colleagues and I are extremely proud and pleased to be able to bring this bill before you this morning. In our state's attempts to address the housing crisis across our state, I do not think that there is a more cost-effective means by which we could attempt to address total number of housing units than is addressed by this particular bill. For a maximum of $25,000, maximum, could be considerably less. For a low-income household, this bill would make it possible to retain a single-family housing unit over an entire generation. If you were to compare that $25,000, it may be $5,000 to fix a roof or a septic tank or something like that. If you were to compare those costs with the costs of building a new housing unit, I think very quickly we see that this is clearly the best bang for the buck in terms of available housing supply out there for low-income Oregonians. And I would also ask that you consider not just the housing costs, but consider the footprint for housing, consider the carbon footprint, consider the energy costs, and savings all the way around. I would also ask, Madam Chair, that the committee consider the impact that House Bill 2961 will have on low-income families who in many instances are close to being trapped in their own homes. It is their most significant asset. They cannot afford to fix up the asset. They cannot afford to move from the asset. They become trapped. And it may be for insufficient capital to fix a leaky roof, which in turn then starts to debilitate the entire residence. It could be hallways that were never constructed to accommodate the use of a wheelchair, and all of a sudden the homeowner or someone in that family unit becomes confined to a wheelchair. It could be furnace or plumbing that have over a course of many, many decades perhaps given up the ghost and need a complete replacement. It may be a sewer or septic system that's backed up and is almost making the home inhabitable. Whatever the cost is cheap in comparison to many of our other attempts to supply adequate housing. I would encourage the committee's support for the $10 million appropriation that the bill calls for to to create the repair and rehab fund specified in the bill. With that, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for your consideration of this bill. I'll turn that over to my colleagues.
Ms. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, Honorable Committee members. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Honored to support House Bill 2961, along with the chief sponsors, Brad Witt and Representative Gomberg, Senator Johnson, and also a Representative Johnson. So it is a bipartisan, as the chair noted, bipartisan bill and bi-chamber. So I've worked with Representative Witt and Gomberg this session in the past on affordable housing issues. I think this is an affordable housing issue. You're going to hear a lot of testimony. Representative Witt did a good job of going through. I think for me also, we're going to use nonprofits to do this, and they know the communities. My nonprofit Neighbor Impact has the housing project. They know the people. They're doing the weather programs now and things like that. So I think this is a good affordable housing bill, and I urge you to support it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Oregon coast. Madam Chair, this is not the first time you've seen this this group up here, and it is a bipartisan, bicameral group, but I should also emphasize that it also is a geographically diverse group, and I think that's an important part of the message as well. The last time we were before you, I was the last one to speak. I said everything's been said, and not everybody's had a chance to say it yet. I've already used that joke, so let me just say me too. Me too. Representative Witt has summed this up well, and I just want to make sure it's very clear that we are all here looking for options and opportunities for people that live throughout Oregon with a variety of different kinds of housing challenges.
For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I proudly represent Senate District 16. I'm going to say I wish to be associated with the comments of my colleagues, but also to make a couple of other comments. I think the fact that this is a collaboration between Habitat for Humanity, the Community Action Network, experienced housing not-for-profits, and advocates speaks volumes. In many rural areas, government is incapable of stepping in to help. In our district, we have relied very heavily on our community action team. And in the interest of full disclosure, my husband happens to be the chair of their board. So I know firsthand what excellent good work they do. When desperate people call our offices trying to figure out how to stay in their homes, and particularly with the mobile home crisis, these are homeowners. We lose track of the fact that that mobile home, that single wide, is their home. And as time has moved on and these houses were never built for durable, over the decades, a small fix keeps somebody in their home. We did a survey of the number of people that are housed in mobile home units in Columbia County, and it is astonishing. Were we to lose that stock, I don't know where we would put people. And so I think sometimes we get a little fixated on the shiny, bright objects of build new, and I think we are here making a plea to say, with a little bit of elbow grease on the part of the not-for-profits, a little bit of ingenuity on the part of the community action teams, a little bit of money from the legislature, we can keep people in homes without having to incur the cost, the land use hassles, all of the permitting that is associated with building new. So this seems an ounce of prevention and money well spent to keep folks housed in what is arguably now one of Oregon's largest crises. Thank you for hearing our bill.
Yeah. Good. Any questions for this panel?
Oh, I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gomberg, is this an emergency?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an emergency.
Oh, okay.
Which is why there's an emergency clause on this bill.
That's why I was asking. That's his favorite thing.
I understood the context of your question, and yes, indeed, this bill and one that will follow need to be moving quickly through the process so that we can begin fixing problems very quickly.
Thank you.
I might also add, if you don't mind, I have fulminated on that point on the Senate floor. I have already voted against a couple of good bills because they had emergency clauses. Yeah. If I were going to be out in the street tomorrow, this is damn well an emergency.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you very much.
Great question, great responses. Thank you so much to this panel. Okay, great. Okay, next we have Jim Tierney, Ken Gaylord, and Shannon Vilhauer.
Interesting.
That's it, right?
That's the bill.
you want to add their names?
Yeah. That's a good one. I like it. Yeah, and a lot of them are in terrible shape.
Chair Geyer, McKinney Geyer, and members of the committee. My name is Jim Tierney. I'm the former, as of November, Executive Director of Community Action Team, the agency that Betsy just talked about. Senator Johnson just talked about. And I find myself, second time in 2 weeks, having Representative Witt taken almost all of my speech. So I will attempt to do better and improvise and be short. I should tell you that I came to Community Action Team in 1984 and started the rehabilitation program there. So we've been doing this a while. We've done thousands of these projects. I have submitted some specific examples in written testimony. So I really want to talk about how this fits into the framework of our work. We have, in Oregon, 1.7 million housing units. Sadly, no one seems to keep track of what's happening with that a massive amount of investment collectively. And so I find myself having to do back-of-the-envelope estimates on this stuff. So let me give you an example of that. If we assume, and I think this is generous, that a housing unit has an average lifespan of 100 years, that means that we're losing 17,000 units every year. And that's something like 60% of them are single-family units. Our work in Oregon towards affordable housing, and we've done both at Community Action Team. We've done tax credit projects, we've done preservation projects, and we've done single-family new construction projects, but we also done rehab. But our focus has been on new development, particularly in multifamily. That's where we've spent almost all of our money. And as Representative Witt pointed out, this is really a conservative way to look. I like to compare it to a family budget. It's not enough to pay attention to your income. You have to pay attention to your expenses. These units that are being lost are like spending in a personal budget. We need to find ways to reduce that spending in order for to improve the whole. As Representative Witt talked about small homes that might need a simple roof, the perfect example is a manufactured home. We have the weatherization program at Community Action Team, and we used to be allowed to take that weatherization program for the purposes of preserving insulation, put a rubber roof on that leaky manufactured home in a mobile home park. We have a little bit of revolving money, and we have money from small, shrinking money from CDBG to do the work we've done in the past. But now we cannot use either of those funds for those manufactured homes. They've been ruled out. And so we can't do anything about the need there. This will help us with that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Why were they ruled out?
Madam Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Gorsuch. Part of it was, it gets complex, so forgive me. The rules for weatherization are pushed very much by the federal government.
Right.
And they got very focused on return on investment. Unfortunately, and I want to pick up on Representative Witt's point, personally, I think carbon footprint matters in this stuff, and if you can preserve a unit, that is really good energy savings.
Right.
That isn't how U.S. Department of Energy and HHS look at it, and that's where the weatherization money comes from.
Okay. Thank you.
The short thing, and I've used up my time, is this bill will allow us to do at least 400 units, and that will more than triple the impact we're able to have given current funding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez and Olson, and members of the committee. I'm Ken Gaylord with Florence Habitat for Humanity. So we represent one of those small communities that don't have a lot of outside resources, and our habitat made the decision a few years ago to really start focusing on where we could have the biggest impact in our community, and that was on home repair and rehabilitation. It's become almost prohibitive for us to build a new home anymore, to find buildable land and find the resources to build new homes. But to do rehabs and repairs, we have a much bigger impact and footprint on our community. In the 3 years that we've been doing home repairs, we've done 41 repairs for families in our neighborhoods, and we are also the first Habitat in the country to become a Medicaid provider for home modifications. Mm-hmm. So we're really looking at how can we best serve our community and keep them safe and healthy in their own existing homes, and keep that housing stock alive and fresh and safe and healthy, and revitalize our neighborhoods at the same time. And so we feel that this is certainly the most cost-effective way to keep houses fresh and alive and affordable. The problem is when a house gets away from you, if somebody comes in and buys that home and turns it into a rental, you're now outside of the affordable housing price. Mm-hmm. And people that want to move into the community don't have a place to live that they can afford to work a minimum wage job. So if we can preserve those homes for homeowners in the affordable range and keep them safe and healthy, then we have really made an impact difference in our communities. So that's, and we've got a short story on our first Habitat Medicaid joint project that we did for Medicaid. It was written up in our national magazine this year on the impact that even a small repair can have on a family. Shelley and Al. Al was bound in a wheelchair, had not been out of the house in months because the wheelchair wouldn't get out the door, and then there were steps. So we widened the door, put a wheelchair ramp. We changed their lives. Al is no longer with us, but Shelley says that it was a defining change in their life that Al, in his last few months of life, was able to get out of the house and go shopping with his wife and enjoy life again. So we know personally the kind of impact that even a small repair can have for a family. So it's a pure passion for us now, and we're looking at that as being the best way that Habitat can support our communities and our families.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Vilhauer. I'm the Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity of Oregon. So today in Oregon, there are 30 local Habitat offices located throughout the state who are building and repairing homes. We've been doing repairs, not even everybody knows, for just a little over 5 years. In that time, we've assisted more than 600 Oregon households, helping them to remain safe and healthy and connected to their communities within their own home. We want to do more. I think it's important to note that of those 600 home repairs, two-thirds were delivered in rural areas. This fund is wonderful, as Jim explained, in part because of its flexibility. Some of our partners at the Community Action Agency in Benton County had energy assistance funds where they could go in and provide new windows and a new HVAC heating cooling system in a home, but they weren't allowed to enter the home if the stairs were broken because of the federal funding rule. And so the local Habitat affiliate says, we build stairs, you know? So it's important to have funding that is flexible, that lets you fill in the gaps and use those federal programs to the greatest extent to serve the most people. And our heart is really in serving folks living in manufactured homes as well as stick-built homes. Meyer Memorial Trust actually sponsored a study, which I need to send your way, that emphasizes the pride of ownership that our Oregon residents living in manufactured homes have, and how for such a cost-effective investment we can help our friends and neighbors be healthy and happy and safe in their homes. So thank you. I'd be happy to entertain any technical questions about the bill.
Questions? I have a bill about financing. So how much money have you gotten from the state in the last biennium compared to the $10 million that you're requesting now?
The current, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, the current budget for housing rehabilitation is, and in the, historically, has only been the community development block grant through Business Oregon. It's down to $1.5 million. Mm. More than that, they put some spin on the baseball in that agency, and we're now really sort of focused on repairs. There's a no bright line between a repair and a rehabilitation. The stairs that Shannon talked about is a good example. But serious rehabilitation takes a little more money, and it's something that they won't they want us to not, or appear to not want us to make them in the form of revolving loans. I can tell you the revolving loans are, we get five times or four times the use out of that money when we can make it a revolving loan. We want the flexibility in this bill to not have it be revolving loans, because manufactured homes need it. Other agencies, for example, Habitat, that's not their model. But for those of us that do have that model, using the revolving loans is really cost effective for everyone involved. So there's some barriers there that make it a little hard, and it's not a lot of money. It's been shrinking. It used to be $7-8 million a year.
If I may speak to that, please, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, we do use both a revolving loan model and loan with regular payments over 5 years. In instances where there's something like a roof, that's going to cost $5,000 to $10,000, and we'll secure that against the asset. But sometimes we're able to really improve someone's living situation for as little as $400, and the cost of servicing the debt would maybe be equal to the repair that we're delivering. So we choose to deliver twice as many repairs in that instance.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. For any of you, I was just wondering, as you were talking about the money and everything, do you ever get assistance from, say, some of the big box realtors? The big box folks that sell building materials and things like that, like a Home Depot. I call it the despot. Lowe's and things like that.
So thank you, Representative Gorsuch, Chair Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee. So, in fact, of those 600-plus home repairs that Habitat has delivered, all of those were funded without any resources from the state of Oregon. We have not had consistent access, like our peers at the community action agencies, to some of those resources. So, in fact, we have generated the money ourselves from community donors. The Oregon Realtors Foundation donated over $500,000 to Habitat within the past 10 years. Statewide at various affiliate levels, the Home Depot partners with us regularly with donations for projects, with cash donations, with contributions to our ReStore, where we generate the income that lets us do these repairs.
Thank you. Guessing the $10 million is just a modest request given our budget situation. Do you have any sense of what the need is out there, how much this will... Is this 10% of the need?
Boy,
3% of the need.
There it is.
Okay. Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. I don't think there's an answer to that right now. As I said earlier, no one is keeping track of this incredibly large public. That's not publicly owned things, but it's a public asset. It belongs to all Oregonians. And we aren't tracking it. But my sense is that we've done thousands of these projects. The problem, one of the biggest problems in Oregon, is that it rains. The houses literally melt if we're not careful. And so there is a need for this, and as people make mistakes as they age, as they decide, well, they'll be able to live on that $400 a month in Social Security, yep, if they have their trailer home in the park paid off, they get into trouble. And my whole career has been dealing with people in that role. This is a deep well, and I think the right way to look at it is each one of these things, just like every unit that you fund that's a new unit, impacts a family and makes a difference. And I do not want to contrast this as rehabilitation versus the new units. Let me give you a number that may help you.
We'll probably have to wrap up.
Oh, sorry. Let me just say that we have 144 units of tax credit projects that we have. I calculated the other day we have about $1 million in rent subsidy. That those units are $1 million below market rent. So that those projects help as well. All of these things help us house the people that don't have the income.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2961, open the House public hearing on House Bill 3175. I'm sorry that Representative Wisnett looks like he just had to leave. But Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 3175 modifies the definition for low-income households, clarifying income levels for households renting and households owning residential housing in the Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Program. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Looks like we just lost your colleague. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, Representative Wisnett had to go to Ways and Means. I don't know if we can still catch him. For your record, once again, I am still David Gomberg, representative from House District 10. Very pleased to be back here to talk about House Bill 3175. And I will be brief, Madam Chair, except to say that this is the, I think, the fourth time that that Representative Wisnett and I have appeared before your committee to talk about these housing issues. I'm afraid at some point you might actually start charging us rent. But I like the point needs to be made, I believe, that Oregon is big and diverse. And we don't need one solution for every place in the state. We need unique and sometimes fine-tuned solutions that'll cover different challenges in different parts of the state. I've looked at the numbers. I have seen dramatic rent increases that the metropolitan areas are suffering. That's not the problem I have in my district. In my district, people aren't concerned about the cost of housing. They're concerned about finding housing with vacancy rates that are well below 0.5%. And so finding a place to live is a challenge in my part of the state that may be different from your part of the state. So that's why we brought you a variety of bills that talk about supply issues. And this is one of them. It's a pretty straightforward bill that just changes some definitions for rental housing versus home ownership within the LIFT program. It's a good bill. It does have an emergency clause on it, Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, because these challenges continue to be an emergency. I'd be happy to answer any questions for you.
Great. And I know we have a number of other people signed up. So if you have technical questions, you may want to wait. Mm-hmm. No questions? Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much
for slipping
us in, Madam Chair.
Both these bills.
And my apologies to those that were waiting for a chance to talk about 2961, another good bill.
We got through all the people who wanted 2961.
All good. Thank you so much.
Yep. Okay, so next on 3175, we have Stacey Daniel, Steve Messinetti, and Diane Lynn.
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez and Olson, members of the committee. I'm Steve Messinetti, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Portland Metro East, which serves all of Multnomah County and northern Clackamas County. At Habitat Portland Metro East, we've been building homes for the past 35 years, 375 homes, in fact, and have seen the impacts that homeownership can have for low-income families firsthand. In fact, last year, we surveyed the 300 families that have first moved into their homes over those years and asked them how their lives have changed since moving in. And we were excited to hear many of the things we've talked about. Parents reported their kids doing better in school, and in fact, 83% of children raised in Habitat homes graduated, which is a 20% higher than the Multnomah County graduation rate. 79% of families who had a family member suffering from respiratory illness reported that they no longer had symptoms once moving into their home. And the use of government subsidies like SNAP significantly dropped within 5 years of a family buying their Habitat home. So with record level increases, as you know, in rents and home prices, underserved populations are especially vulnerable. Just this year, our Habitat affiliate had 700 families approach us for our housing program. And we are proud that of the 32 families we were able to build homes for and sell them, 90% were families of color, 43% were single parent households, and 30% of them had a family member with a disability. The national research has shown us that the benefits of home ownership really are threefold. Benefits come from having a stable home, having an affordable payment, and having a built-in savings plan. And this is the reason that our affiliate has chosen this year to commit to all of our homes being permanently affordable going forward. This land trust model ensures that the family can stay in their gentrifying neighborhood and that their home will be affordable to a family into the future as well. The LIFT funds for home ownership would significantly expand our ability to serve more families and help close the minority home ownership gap, because our greatest barrier to do more of this work is the land, the cost of land. And we have donors and we have volunteers lined up to support our work. We have families lined up to buy houses. If we can take that land out of that equation, we can do more work immediately. Also, every unit of affordable home ownership we build really creates two units. The rental unit the family's moving out of, which is either a subsidized unit or an affordable unit, as well as the unit that gets built. So let's help more homeowner-ready families get out of their rental units and free those up for families while they can enjoy the benefits of home ownership and financial independence. So I urge you to support HB 3175 and to dedicate $20 million of LIFT toward helping 500 households earning between 30% and up to 80% median income to buy their first homes. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chairs Sanchez and Olson. My name is Stacey Daniel. I'm the Director of Policy and Advocacy for NeighborWorks Umpqua. NeighborWorks Umpqua serves Southern Oregon, and as a rural organization, we're required to do a lot of different programs. So we do home ownership through housing counseling. We have an individual development account program. We do repair and rehab. We do down payment assistance. We do foreclosure prevention. We also do affordable housing and community and economic development. So in the rural areas, there's a lot of things that need to be addressed. And one of the issues that happens in rural areas is that throughout Oregon, area median income means a lot of different things. There's about 28,000 difference, almost $29,000 difference between the highest and the lowest area median income in Oregon. And so, for example, if you are a household in Douglas County, one year I was doing some research and I found out that if you lived in Roseburg, you were not able to access services at an income that was $20,000 less than if you lived in Plymouth. That's a significant difference for communities that are very similar. And so I think it's really important that in order for local communities to meet their need, that they have the flexibility of not being so confined to that 30 to 60% and really being able to go up to that 80%. In Douglas County, if you are at 80% of area median income and you're a family of four, and you have very modest debt, you can afford a house of about $160,000. A typical home and a modest home in good repair in our area for the people that are buying now that we're helping buy, they're looking at $175,000 to $185,000. So even at the 80% of area median income, there can be a significant gap. We are hoping to see these LIFT funds become available for home ownership. We're hoping to use them to do land trust housing, which takes away that cost of the land, which is a significant addition to the cost of a home, and to again make these homes permanently affordable. The difference that home ownership can make, I think in any area this is true, but I think particularly in rural areas where rental options are fewer and home ownership rates are higher, I'll just give you an example from myself. I bought a home in 2012 in Roseburg, and at that time, my house payment was about $200 more than average area rents. My children recently moved back to Roseburg, and they're paying more in rent every month than my house payment. So in only 3 or 4 short years, my house payment is less than area rents. So this is a really significant resource for rural areas. We do need repair and rehab. I know that we're not testifying on this, but I'll just tell you we have lots of demand for that. But we also need new construction. You've got to have a balance in any area. And so these are really important funds for the rural areas. The flexibility is really important for Oregon, and we just urge you to support this this fix on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Geyer, Kenny Geyer. Very happy to be here, very grateful to be able to testify on this bill this morning. I'm Diane Lynn, Executive Director of Proud Ground. We use the Community Land Trust model to create permanently affordable housing for working families, and we're working really more and more all around the state. We're very grateful to have the opportunity to explain to you just how very important it is to allow the LIFT funds to be able to serve families between 60% and 80% of median income for the reasons you just heard from my colleagues. And I'm here to share that those working families are actually able to bring a conventional mortgage to the table, matching and leveraging the state funds, and also are able to avoid private mortgage insurance that can really add a burden, as I'm sure you know as a realtor, to the ongoing affordability for working families. So again, when you can match state funds with what families can bring, they've qualified. We serve about 270, we have 270 homes in our portfolio in the Portland metropolitan area, but we also work with Lincoln County to build their stock of permanently affordable workforce housing. And as you just heard from Stacy, the area median income there is much, much, much lower than it is in the Portland metropolitan area. And these LIFT funds would really not be useful to them if we aren't able to extend it up to families up to 80%. They're the working families there that are really the driving force behind the tourism industry along the coast, and one of the reasons the chief sponsor for this bill is from that area. So it's very important to consider the implications statewide for this effort. We've tested effective ways to leverage surplus lands and bring the resources together in some of the rural parts of the community, and we think this could be a huge boost to our efforts. We are deeply committed to helping reduce the minority homeownership gap in these efforts, and have a rich history of doing that. About 50% of the homes that we serve in the Portland area, in the city of Portland, have people of color in those homes, and 63% of the families on our wait list are families of color that really were left out years and years ago over the course of time. We partner with culturally specific agencies. We all work very closely together in collaboration, and we appreciate the chair's encouragement of us to bring our agenda together, and this is a result of that effort. And we're really, again, trying to leverage all of our assets to serve as many families as possible statewide. We're anxious to answer any questions you have, and look forward to, again, counting on your support for House Bill 3175.
Thank you so much. And I want to take the liberty to try to give a little bit of the backdrop to the LIFT program. I thought it might come out in all the testimonies today, and it didn't. And 6 of the 9 people here are new to this committee. So just to give you the backdrop, and then I would like to invite you to correct me. I'll try to do it from my memory. So one of the things that we have all been hearing about is the necessity for supply. We've got to have some supply. We of course, want to preserve what we have, we want to acquire what we can, but we need to have new construction. Mm-hmm. And so as some people may know, in the Portland area, we just had a bond for, I think, $258 million to try to create new rental supply. In the state, we haven't been putting any money into that at all. And so in the last biennium, there was a request for $100 million for this LIFT program, which is the Local Innovation Fast Track for affordable housing for families, and it was not in statute designated only for rentals. But what happened was we only ended up getting $40 million, I believe, for that. Mm-hmm. And the decision was made at the time, well, let's just put it in rentals. Let's start simply. Let's not try to do home ownership as well. But now that that program has rolled out and we had the application process and there's a lot of the grants have been made and there's a lot of new construction that's on track, the idea is to come back, ask for $100 million again, and this time around, expand the definition of low income. Before it was 60%, which going up to 60% of MFI allows us to build rentals. But if you want to make this really usable for people who would like to purchase the units, that the 60% is really hard to put the financing together when people are at 60%. And so by allowing it to go up to 80% and being able to leverage other kinds of financing out there, this will be more doable. So am I describing that correctly? I want to make sure you knew the background. In my view, $100 million, which will be the request, which is not attached to this, this is just expanding the definition to make it more usable if the decision is made to allow some of that $100 million, and the request will be 20% of it, of what comes out of that to go to home ownership. But it's just changing the definition that we had put in statute a couple of years ago to make it more usable if the decision is made that some of it will be allocated to home ownership. So I think it's great. I think home ownership is a really important piece of the equation along with rentals. The more flexible we can be so we can meet needs around the state, I think is great. $100 million was not in this bill, but you'll be hearing that request out there. In my view, is really way too meager for the incredible need out there. But I'm passionate about making sure that we get at least that much. So are there any, would you like to correct anything that I said? Because you're steeped in this, and I have a layperson's memory and perspective on it.
I would just, I think, really like to reemphasize the fact that the state of Oregon has made no investments in new homeownership development statewide, and we've really missed an opportunity. And these coming years, the urgency around this, given the market forces and the increased costs all around the state, not just in the metropolitan area, but also statewide, is really becoming important. If we missed the opportunity now, it'll just become that much harder farther down the road. So thank you for emphasizing the importance of this very important investment in new homeownership development.
Yep.
And the urgency is really critical.
Okay, great. Any other questions for the panel? Nope. I think that's it then, right? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3175. And I see Representative Vile here, so I'm going to move him up. Representative Meek, if that's all right, and open House Bill 2210. Cassie, can you read the summary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2210 directs Housing and Community Services to develop and implement the Retaining Affordable Rental Housing Program to provide grants for rehabilitation and maintenance of multifamily rental housing at an affordable rental rate. The bill requires OHCS to administer and monitor the program in areas without a housing authority or enter into agreements with local housing authorities to administer and monitor the program. The bill creates the Retaining Affordable Housing Rental Housing Program Fund and continuously appropriates money to OHCS for the program. There is a sub-referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rich Vile, House District 26, Shoals, Sherwood, Wilsonville, and South Hillsborough. This is a bill that I filed pre-session when I knew so little about this process that I can't even hardly begin to tell you. I inherited the bill from my predecessor, whose very, very large shoes I'm attempting to fill, John Davis, and I knew very little about it at the time. Since then, I've tried to get up to speed on the concept that Representative Davis was attempting to bring to us, and I'm actually quite enthusiastic about the idea. I've now found that in my district, and I believe in many other districts, there are a category of landowners or property owners that are maybe a little bit different from anyone that we've looked to before in terms of trying to preserve low-cost housing. These are sort of the mom-and-pop small to medium-sized apartment owners. And they may have units that are anywhere from 10 or 15 years old to 50 to 60 years old, but they have some pride of ownership. Many of these owners are beginning to get a little bit older. They need the income, but they don't necessarily need the income to the level of managing debt service like a lot of folks do on newer projects. These are also, in many cases, folks that have a very close affinity to the people that they've been renting to for an awful long time. They've developed relationships with them. In many cases, because of the levels of rents and the cost of maintenance, they're not terribly short, but just a little bit short of being able to make the necessary repairs to keep those units in the kind of shape that they can take pride in and that really provide the housing for the folks that are there. So the bill is very simple. It does not ask for a specific amount of money. I am hoping that if we can get the policy concept to get some legs under it, that downstream we can look for some money. The bill does, however, allow for contributions from the private sector to be made into a fund. In other words, a fund is set up that can collect money from a variety of places, government and non-government, specifically to help this category of property owner make sure that they continue to service that portion of the population that we've had so many concerns about. That's about all I have for you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Hey, any questions?
Yes, Representative Sanchez. Madam Chair, is there a... So I appreciate this very much. I actually like the idea because I've talked to several people who sort of fit in that category and have snarled about some other bills that we're looking at. But how are we doing that? How are we specifying that group of folks? Is there income parameters, unit parameters?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Sanchez, we have not specifically in the bill as it's currently written attempted to set those rules. I suspect that the Housing and Community Services Department would want to adopt more specificity with respect to that. But frankly, it is targeted, as I said, at it's 10 or larger. We're not looking at the folks that have just one or two, you know, a duplex or whatever. It is 10 or larger. The way it's set up, it is intended to just give them $10,000 per unit, no more than $10,000 per unit, to do the kinds of repairs that keep them at a level that would be serviceable. Other than that, it would be left up to the department to set the rules.
And it does define affordable rental rate as not exceeding 30% of median family income for a family of four.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct.
Yes, that's good. Good. Thank you for bringing this idea. You sound way more on top of it than you made right. It out to be.
Well, the learning curve is steep, but I'm working hard to get up that hill.
It is. That's great.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. All right. No one else on that one, right? So we're going to close the House public hearing on House Bill 2210. I'm going to ask Elise, is your testifier here for the next bill?
She's parking.
Okay. So I'm going to move to open a work session, and I'm going to work session. Oh, can we do that yet?
We can do all of them except for 2938.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bills 3012, 2937, 2456, and I'm holding off on 2938 for now. I'm opening all three of these at a time to explain what's happened with these and get comments from you. And hopefully will we get the paperwork before the end of the meeting for the last one?
Hopefully.
Okay. So these are four bills that we heard last week. The first one, 3012, was Representative Leininger's siting of residential structures on rural residential land, and it was for the historic preservation. We heard a lot of testimony. Most of it was in favor. There was one opposing from a planning group. So if you have any questions about which one that was, please ask me. But it's a very narrow group. It's about 3,000 to 5,000 homes that could possibly be eligible for this. So the impact on land use was perceived as less, and the benefits of keeping some of these historic homes and allowing landowners to build another home on the property so they didn't have to replace it to comply with the regulation of only one residence on the property was the idea behind this bill. The second one, 2937, came out as a committee bill from Ag and Natural Resources to allow accessory dwellings like ADUs on rural residential land and farmland. We heard some opposition and some support, and a lot more of the opposition, I would say, was focused on the farmland aspect of that. And I'll just mention, although we don't have a public work session on it, right now, 2938 was a similar bill that would allow RVs on rural residential land and on farmland. And again, there was some support, there was some opposition, and more of the opposition was focused on the farmland piece of it. And then Representative Parrish had 2456, and that was to develop allow nonprofits on rural residential land to develop affordable housing units. And so I thought we had a really good hearing, and this is the Committee on Human Services and Housing. And when we look at supply issues, I think that it received – I haven't had a chance to talk to you. I've talked to my two vice chairs. I haven't had a chance to talk to others. But I think when you put your housing lens on it, I think there seemed to be a pretty warm support for the idea of having more units out there. So some of the conversations I've had since then with people who both supported and opposed it had to do with, is it right to have development on the rural, residential, and the farmland? Mm. It seemed like farmland there was a lot more opposition to, but I think the real question that I kept asking was, well, what about rural, residential? And some of the concerns that came up were things like the public health aspects of septic tanks in rural residential areas that are breaking down and the sludge goes into waterways, and it's a big public health concern. Is there enough water wells? Is there enough, if a lot of these units chose to build another unit or have an RV, what would that do to the roads, et cetera? And I felt that that was really out of the purview of this committee, mm-hmm. that it really should, if we could look at it with a housing lens, and perhaps be quite supportive. I will say that I felt quite supportive in terms of keeping my housing lens on. But if we really want any sideboards on it, and I started considering doing sideboards in this committee and bringing them back to you, and I started working with groups on what would some of those sideboards look like, it seemed to me that the better policy option would be to send that to the committee that deals with land use issues, that has the overall framework. That we try to do as much development as possible. We try to direct all of our development into the UGB areas, and then we try to protect rural residential and farmland for other uses. And so to what extent are we going to encroach in that? Felt like that needed a different policy lens. So what my bringing this back for a work session and having worked with the chair of that committee over the last couple of days, he has a very big docket, as we do, and he was concerned about can he work this in, but he has agreed to take these bills, and the idea is that I'm trying to work with the advocates to say, here are some of the ideas I've heard, you need to get together, bring some sideboards to this, to the committee, so that you can address some of the land use concerns. So I wanted to say that overall I felt pretty positive about these with my housing lens. Yeah.
So there's not going to be any amendments like to 2937?
So we're not going to have any of the amendments there, but so any amendments on any of these four bills will be considered on the Ag and Natural Resource Committee that is considering, that has the land use expertise. So I welcome any questions about that before we take a formal vote on moving it to that committee. Any questions, any comments about these bills?
Madam Chair, I'm not terribly thrilled about moving 2937 over to another committee and then hoping that they do something with farmland. I like most of this. I just don't think we should be putting more residential into farmland. Rural residential, sure. So I'm a little uncertain about that. Not very happy.
Yeah. I think that's part of the reason why we kind of had that conversation was because we are concerned about it as well and don't really feel like that's within our purview to kind of make that determination. This is part of the reason why we sort of said that's more of an answer for ag and natural resources to say whether or not that's a doable situation. That's definitely my response on it, or my understanding is, like, I don't think that I know enough about farmlands to say that it's a doable situation to put an ADU on there. And if it's not, then they're better able to answer that question than I am.
As long as they really address this and it doesn't get sidelined and not dealt with.
Yep.
I don't know that I trust another committee to have the same interests that we have.
Oh, I mean, I think that committee definitely has those interests. I will say that I think farmland is unlikely to pass. I think that these bills would have a very hard time passing with farmland. If it were in this committee, it would be taken off the table because I think there was a lot of opposition to it. By passing it on, we're letting another committee make that decision. But I feel like there's pretty strong sentiment about farmland being way more problematic, and farmland has way more allowances than rural residential does for units being built for family or for hardship or for a number of different reasons. So, and also for workforce housing. So that's the extent of the conversations. I've had conversations with a lot of the people who both supported and didn't support these bills. And I think there's a lot of good work to be done to put sideboards on the bills so that they can be considered in the next committee. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the thoughtfulness and the consideration we're going through. And as the Housing Committee, and we're talking about policy, how and homelessness exists in rural communities just like it does in urban and suburban communities. And I would just hope that if any of these bills here reflected some of the policy changes we would like to see, that we would potentially be able to work them and then maybe have subsequent referral to Ag and Resources if they determine or they have better... So we can kind of delve through the policies we're trying to work with for housing and addressing those issues and how we can help these communities. And then when it comes to the brass tacks of the farming community, EFU, and whether we allow the counties to make those, because a conditional use is not a permitted use, it's a conditional use, and they have to go through a process with their either the county, city, or whoever is handling, you know, the permitting process for whatever additional housing they're going to allow. And from my perspective, any of these bills that we can potentially work related to trying to address the housing issue, mm-hmm. I would like to see, and maybe we can have a discussion about that.
So, Madam Chair, I'm okay with where you're wanting to go with the direction of this. I understand the conversation that we had last night. I think if Representative Meek and Corsick have that kind of a concern, they should just get their tents and camp outside.
Camp outside the Ag and Natural Resource
Committee?
That's
exactly right.
Okay.
There's no guarantee, though, is what I'm saying. And we should be able to say...
There's no guarantee.
We should be able to say that Ag is off the table right here.
So if we were to put any amendments at all, it slows up the process having amendments, and then we have very little time left for that committee to look at it.
All right, but so Madam Chair, we have a long history in the state of Oregon of trying to preserve and protect farmland. And so timelines or not, I think that we need to say something about the importance of preserving that.
Yep. I will say as a chair, if this were in my committee, the farmland would be off the table. I think any feelings that you have, you should convey to the committee. It sounds like there's some strong sentiment for the bills going forward in order to have some kind of supply. At least some of these bills would add some units. And so if you have feelings about that, I would say talk to people on that committee. If you have concerns and want some of the sideboards, I'm certainly willing to share some of the ideas for sideboards that have been given to me that I'm going to be passing on to that committee, things like the septic tank, things like if you're going to put an ADU on the urban reserve area, that makes it very hard to divide and increase density later, so maybe those areas should be exempted. Once we started getting into that level of sideboards, I felt like this is now kind of outside the purview of the housing committee. This should, to do really good policy in this building, we should look at it with a housing lens and say what kinds of things we think are reasonable to consider for a housing lens, but for us then to consider those kind of amendments in this committee when we don't have that kind of expertise, and then possibly send some to the floor or be worried about them and not send them to the floor because of land use concerns, didn't feel like the right place. So this was really just a pure policy decision to say that that committee that deals with land use issues should put that kind of policy lens on these bills. But by sending them on at all, we're saying they should be considered because they could have died in this committee, and that is not my recommendation. I think they should go on and be vetted with a land use lens to what degree we allow rural development on rural residential land and what kind of sideboards should be there if there is more development and more people living on rural residential land. That really should be something that their committee would have the final stamp on before sending it to the floor. We are, we've been waiting for the paperwork because even to move anything, we need to have paperwork like fiscals. And so that's why we've been kind of waiting on this. So I'm going to go ahead on the three. I'm going to open one by one the three that we have the paperwork on and hope that by the end of the meeting we get the paperwork on the last one, because by the end of this meeting, if for this all to happen, it's got to get to Representative Clem's committee soon, so he has the time. And I just want to, again, encourage the advocates and proponents and opponents that I've talked to in the last couple days to really get together and make sure that you've got your amendments, because what needs to happen in his very full docket is this needs amendments that have had a lot of work, a lot of agreement, perhaps getting opponents to neutral, and a work session and pass them out of his committee. So that I want to thank Representative Clem because he has a very busy schedule too, and encourage advocates, if you want to see this happen, to really work to get the amendments to him. So I'm going to now thank you. Open one by one. House Bill 3012. Could you please read the summary, and then we'll take a vote on sending it to the committee.
House Bill 3012 allows the construction of a new single-family dwelling on a parcel of land zoned for rural residential use if an existing historic home is present on the site and converted into an accessory dwelling unit. The bill prohibits an owner constructing a new single-family dwelling from subdividing the lot or parcel apart from the ADU, prohibits renovations increasing the square footage by 120%, and prohibits rebuilding the ADU if the structure is lost to fire. We last heard this bill on March 14th, and we have both the fiscal and the revenue. The fiscal requires further analysis, and the revenue has no impact.
Okay. Chair Kenegeyer, I move House Bill 3012 without recommendation to House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 3012 without recommendation to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Is there any discussion about this particular bill? Any objection? Okay. Could you please call the roll?
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenegeyer?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 3012 moves to the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3012, open a work session on House Bill 2937. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 2937 allows an accessory dwelling unit on land zoned either for exclusive farm use or rural residential use if constructed within 100 feet of an existing single-family home and complies with county residential unit standards. We heard this bill on March 14th, and we have both the fiscal and the revenue, and both are minimal impacts.
Okay.
Chair Kenegeyer, I move House Bill 2937 without recommendation to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2937 without recommendation to the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. Any discussion? Any objection?
Yes.
Okay. So noted, and please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch.
No.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Nierman.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Peluso.
Aye.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye.
Chair Kingai.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2937 moves to the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources, and I close the work session on that. Open a work session on House Bill 2938. Cassie, I'm sorry. Open a work session on House Bill 2456.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2456 allows tax-exempt nonprofit organizations or religious corporations to develop affordable housing units on lands zoned for rural residential use in collaboration with local government and nonprofit organizations. The bill requires counties with jurisdiction over zoned rural residential land to develop a process for nonprofit organizations seeking to build affordable housing units. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We last heard this bill on March 14th. We have the fiscal, which is indeterminate, and the revenue, which has no impact.
Okay.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2456 without recommendation to House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2456 without recommendation to the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm in favor of this bill, and I like what it gives opportunities to either churches and nonprofits in those communities. And I thought it seemed thoughtful that each county could have take into consideration the building constraints. They take into consideration the services, the water, wells, all those things as part of this process, and to allow, if it's a church or a nonprofit, the opportunity to house some folks, that maybe even their own parish members, that I just hate to see this leave and not have an opportunity to see the light of day again. And for that reason, I would vote nay.
And I just want to say it will see the light of day in the next committee. I appreciate that, and I appreciate Representative Parrish's efforts to find any opportunity to find land so that affordable housing, this is the only one of the four that deals directly with affordable housing. It's got a good definition on affordable housing. I would encourage Representative Parrish to see if she wants to limit the kinds of nonprofits. Is it any nonprofit, or perhaps the number of units? So I'll be encouraging her to work with some of the people who have land use concerns to say, do we want to leave this totally up to the county? So a county might say, yeah, it's fine to do 80 units out there, or should there be some kind of parameters? So again, all four of these, even Rep. Leininger's, which is a pretty narrow focus of how many properties are subject to it, in my view, should have the same lens. But I appreciate your comments, and thank you for saying that you really agree with the intent of the law.
Just a quick rebuttal. Thank you, Madam Chair. Even in my community, not necessarily in my district, but in our county, that we have folks that have land available that would like to go out and present and make some nonprofits to help house some of our veterans or homeless, that this would be a wonderful tool. But right now they're stifled, and we could really get a lot of good things going right now. So that's just, I'm passionate about this, and I would love to make a decision on this. But so thank you.
And I will say that anyone who has learned about these bills, who may want to testify in front of that committee, and be a voice from your own voice as well as carrying the sentiment of this committee to that committee, I think that would be very appropriate.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so. Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative Meek.
Nay.
Representative Nierman.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Peluso.
Aye.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye.
Chair Kingai.
Aye. Okay. House Bill 2456 moves to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources, and I close the work session on that. And we just got the paperwork for House Bill. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2938. This is the RV. Could you please read the...
House Bill 2938 allows a recreational vehicle for residential purposes on land zoned for either exclusive farm use or rural residential use if placed within 100 feet of an existing single-family dwelling and has functioning sleeping, cooking, and plumbing facilities. We last heard this bill on March 14th, and we have both the fiscal and the revenue. There's a minimal fiscal, and the revenue requires further analysis.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2938 without recommendation to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2938 without recommendation to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Any discussion on this bill?
I'll be voting no for the same reason as before.
Okay.
Same here, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. So any further objection you'd like to state for the record? Nope. Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Borsig?
No.
Representative Meek?
Nay.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kinney-Dyer?
Aye. Before I gabble that one, I just want to make sure I understand for the record. So, Representative Gorsuch, your no was based on not wanting to pass it out of this committee while farmland is still included in the bill.
Correct.
And Representative Meek, your no was based on?
Based on the county commissioners that were in support of it and wanting to have it.
Wanting
a vote
to
on.
See it go through and come
yes.
out of this committee and not go so come
yes,
from this
Chair.
Committee to the floor, not to. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, with that, I will close the work session on. Yes? So it moves to Ag and Natural Resources, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2938. I'm now going to open a work house the public hearing on House Bill 3192. Representative Meek, would you like to
yes, Madam
present
Chair.
This? And we'll have a summary from Cassie.
House Bill 3192 establishes the Home Ownership Down Payment Assistance Program within Housing and Community Services Department to provide grants to eligible nonprofit organizations, housing authorities, and local governments to provide financial assistance to first-time low-income home buyers for purchase of single-family residences. The bill defines low-income households as households with an income at or less than 100% of the area median income. The bill specifies the qualifications and application process for eligible organizations, housing authorities, or local government, including demonstration of capacity to administer grant funds. The bill also requires grant program recipients to report to OHCS annually regarding the status and use of grant funds and establishes the Home Ownership Down Payment Assistance Program Fund and continuously appropriates money to fund the program at OHCS. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2018, and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017, and there is a sub-referral to House Revenue.
Thank you, Madam Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Olson. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Meek, representative for House District 40, and I am excited to be in front of you, this committee today talking about a bill that will boost our state's efforts to support affordable home ownership. The existing down payment assistance program provides up to $20,000 in down payment assistance to qualified families with modest means who otherwise would not be able to become homeowners. And just quickly, I want to get everybody's attention. Who on the committee panel right now is a homeowner? Please raise your hand. And just think back to your first experience of buying your first home. Where did that down payment money come from? Was it assistance from support from your family? Did you, you know, work very hard for many, many years? Did you win the lottery?
Didn't have it back then.
Yeah. Regardless, before you bought that first house, you were probably wondering, how am I ever going to get enough money to buy my own first house? Because most families right now, they can afford the payment. They just can't come up with a down payment. And so this program will provide our families that have modest means, but that and are within, see, when you think about the 80% median income, if we limit to that limit, if you have folks trying to buy a home in the metropolitan area, it's very difficult. And so by raising it to the 100%, I think that will be very helpful.
and also it will qualify many more homeowners. The second part of the equation is that the reason we're asking for the additional $5 million is that because right now, at $1 million, we're only helping less than 100 families in Oregon. And how much is that helping? You know, there's thousands of folks that are really ready, willing, and able to buy a home minus that down payment. And so I think this would go a long way. We could that additional $5 million would help us serve an additional 250 families across the state. There's many times that I'm at an open house and I have people stumble in. Oh, this is a cute house, and how much would my house payment be? And I talk to them a little bit. I give them a disclosure that I'm representing the seller there, and let them know that they have the opportunity to select an agent. I'm just telling that for all the real estate agency out there right now. But then I talk to them and say, you know, well, in order to buy this, you probably could qualify, but are you ready for your down payment? And on average, if you get an FHA loan, it's going to be 3.5% down. And if this $300,000 unaffordable house, $300,000 is like a minimum that it needs for just a first-time home buyer's house, it's amazing. But that's going to be almost $10,500 that they're going to have to come up with. And if they have $3,000, they thought they were making it close, they're just that much more shorter. What I love about this program is that to be a homeowner, it takes disciplines. All of you are homeowners. You know that things happen. Hot water heaters go out. And you have to be very judicious with your budgeting. And you have to work hard. You have to put in a little extra labor. But there's nothing like – and so what I like about this program, it helps build and gives the educational process to home buyers to learn the disciplines to be a good, responsible homeowner. And I think part of the crisis in 2005, 6, and 7 before the crash and the recession was that there was a process where if you were breathing and you could get a non-stated income loan at 100%, potentially 110% of the loan, without any requirement to really understand what you're getting into. And so this program gives our buyers, we're not giving anybody anything, we're giving them an opportunity to stabilize themselves and hopefully build some generational wealth for them and their family to come. So that's for this reason that I'm here today to help support House Bill 3192. And at this time, I will answer any questions, if there are any more, but also give you an opportunity to ask some of the experts that are going to be following me.
Okay. Yes, Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Meek, I like this bill a lot. As I said, I am a homeowner, and I bought my home over 20 years ago on something similar to this type of program. Because, of course, I didn't have a huge income at that point either. And let me just say, the word grant was in that information that I received.
Correct.
When, in fact, it was not a grant.
Yours or this one?
Mine.
Oh, yeah.
And ended up having to pay a huge sum of money at one point in time when I refinanced that house. But I just want to, you know, I just want to say that, you know, clarity is really, really important, and I appreciate the fact that this, as I'm reading, says straight out grant with some, you know, some parameters around it. I think it's an important and amazing thing because it's an opportunity there for, you know, someone such as myself. I've owned my home for 20 years now, and it was a really wonderful opportunity to get that. Again, those little bitty things here and there, but as long as people are well informed and have those classes up front and have a lot of information up front, I think it's going to be really, really an important thing, in particular that large amount of money now, sadly, that it's going to take to actually have a down payment on a house. So
exactly. And thank you, Vice Chair Sanchez. I want to explain that program because the funds that we're going to be giving into to these families, the state of Oregon is, or these nonprofits are going to be participating in the generational wealth of this. If, say, your grant, you give that grant, well, after this, the homeowner, if they sell within the first 10 years, the way I think it's written, they sell it, then they will actually be repaying that funds, those funds back to the, you know, to the state, to the, so it goes back into a revolving fund, and there's also going to be some participation. We'll have more money coming back to the program, and it's a win-win situation. It is a win-win because although Representative Vice Chair Sanchez had to pay a little bit of that back, she Actually, you did build, hopefully, some equity in that also, participated in some good equity. So thank you very much. I hope if anybody, I hope I can get your support on this and get it through Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, so to testify on this, 3192, Emily Ryman, Erica Calderon, and Hector Rodriguez.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Ryman. I'm the executive director of NEDCO, the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation. We are, among other things, one of the regional housing centers that are available statewide to provide homeownership education, counseling, and resources to low-income first-time homebuyers. I'm here today to speak in support of this down payment assistance bill. The committee has heard a lot this morning about the importance of homeownership in this state. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but I just want to reiterate a couple of things. Homeownership is the most powerful tool we have to help low and moderate income homeowners permanently move out of poverty and move into the middle class. It's a tool that does a number of really important things. Among others, it provides safe and stable housing where people can count on their children being able to stay in the same schools. It provides, you know, a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is about as stable a rent as you can get over time. It provides security in retirement, both from a housing perspective and a financial perspective. It's also the most important tool we know to reduce the racial wealth gap and to help overcome the intergenerational wealth gap. We can do all of that through homeownership with a relatively modest investment per family from the state. The bad news about homeownership in Oregon is that it is out of reach for the vast majority of low-income people and for more and more moderate-income people. Oregon actually ranks 46th out of 50 states for unaffordability of homeownership. We are near the bottom of the nation. That is because of a lot of years of relatively flat median income levels and a lot of years of unfortunately rapidly rising housing prices. What we have is a generation of Oregon families that are going to be priced out of the opportunities available to them via homeownership if we don't collectively respond to this crisis as a state. We need a lot of tools to help address this. You've heard about some of them today. You've heard about some of them over the last couple of weeks. Down payment assistance is a really important tool among that spectrum for the homeowners that, as Representative Meek said, have the stable income to afford a mortgage payment. They've done the hard work to build the credit that they need. They probably have even saved a little bit of their own money for closing costs, but they just can't meet the hurdle of that down payment to get into the house. Right now, as a state, we have just a little bit over $1 million a year available to provide in down payment assistance. For NEDCO, that means that we get about $100,000 for the biennium in DPA to make available to clients. That means that for our territory of Lane County, Marion County, and Clackamas County, we can help 12 homeowners per biennium, which is just a drop in the bucket compared to the hundreds of homeowners that come through our education and counseling programs. We're here in full support of this request for $5 million. Also for the increase of median income from 80% to 100%. We find in a lot of our areas that that will be an important change. And also to the idea that down payment assistance could be up to $20,000. We won't always need that. We serve some communities where $5,000 is enough, and we will certainly choose to do the $5,000 and help more families. But in some communities, we need the flexibility to be able to go up to $20,000. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erica Calderon, and I'm the program manager of the Homeownership Department with Hacienda CDC. I echo a lot of with what my colleague Emily says in similarities between what my agency does and what Emily's agency does, which is the difference that we overlook Multnomah County. I kind of want to touch a little bit on what Representative Meek said at the beginning and going back to the recession, because this is where I feel it's important to voice what really happened during that time and just kind of remind everybody in the room that over 53% of African Americans lost wealth during that recession. 54% of Asians lost wealth, and Hispanics lost over 65% of their wealth, meaning anybody moving forward that wants to help their children out right now to get into homeownership is very tough. And as a minority group, Hispanics are the fastest growing minority in the country. And I think it's very important that with down payment assistance like this coming through and more of it, we are addressing, even if it is a drop in the bucket or a little bit more, we're helping them out in that community that is in dire need of that. Just a couple numbers through Hacienda CDC that I've been looking at. Although the average home buyers that come in for education through us have anywhere between $3,000 to $5,000 in savings already, anywhere for a house in the upper $280,000, closing costs and down payments are averaging about $18,000. So we're seeing a gap of about $7,500 that are needed for everyone that's coming through. And that's the gap that we're trying to cover. With programs like this, like Emily just mentioned, if we're able to go up to $20,000, $15,000, we're able to help most people on average. And then with the surplus, we're able to help even more people out with that. So thank you.
Buenos dias. Thank you for having me here. And I want to express my concern about the down payment assistance programs.
Could you give your name?
My name is Hector Rodriguez. I'm a homeownership counselor with Hacienda CDC. I'm also a student of the Master Program for Urban and Regional Planning. I'm here because I'm concerned about affordable housing and the need of the down payment assistance program. I think that those two things go together. I believe that homeownership is the core for a sustainable future. We're talking about more homeownership. We're going to have more sense of community. We're going to have long-term taxpayers. Right now, as a counselor, I deal with this every single day. I'm seeing families that don't qualify for the down payment assistance because they are above the 80%, but they also can't afford paying rent and continue saving money. Right now, the gap that I'm seeing is about covering closing fees or down payment. They cannot do both and continue paying rent. The gap is about $7,500 per family. Last month, I helped five families of color to get through home ownership, and it's only thank you to this type of assistance. Every week, I see over three families that come out to our workshops. It's 30 families per week that come on seeking for help because they know that without this type of assistance, they won't be able to achieve home ownership. We are a team of three counselors, and we met like 48 families that are going through counseling. Over 85% of those families, they need the down payment assistance. In many of those cases, having a gap of 80% is not realistic. Right now, the median income in Portland doesn't align with the prices on the market. So I agree that raising the MFI requirement to 100%, it will make an impact. And that's all. Thank you.
That's great. Questions from the panel? I have a question about where the $1 million has been coming from to date. Sounds like the state has been putting in $1 million. You're requesting $5 million.
Yeah, Chair Kenninger, members of the committee, the current resource that we have actually comes from the dock recording fee. So the $20 existing dock recording fee, 14% of that by statute goes for homeownership programming, and a portion of that 14% is allocated to fund down payment assistance.
And it comes to about $1 million?
I believe it's a little over $1 million. Yes, we could find the exact number for you.
Right.
We are, of course, supporting the request to raise the dock recording fee this year. We're hoping that will increase the existing resource. And what we'd like is a total of $5 million.
Okay. So if we're able to double it, you'd get more from that source, and we could use less from the general fund.
Correct.
Great. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3192. Yes.
Okay,
I won't close it yet.
If you don't mind me adding one comment, and my apologies, I had a little step out for just a second. And for Rep. Meek, to put out there with this program, I hope people are aware of the Home Path program. Home Path is a fantastic program that, to my understanding, originated with homes that had been foreclosed on at one point and are bank-owned, and the bank allows people to purchase these with very little down payment. And in fact, I purchased a home with 3% down and no reserves, and that's a big deal to be able to do that, and that's without having to pay the additional mortgage interest. So there are some really good programs. Now, that's a limited stock. that's available. That's a really good program that, you know, regardless of what happens with this bill, I encourage you to make sure people know about Home Path loans and look into that as well.
That could make their money stretch a lot farther if they help people have to just qualify for, just put down 3%. Okay, thank you. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3192 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2996 with Representative Meegan. And is Representative
Johnson
here?
Is here, too.
Come on up. Yes, Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2996 allows an individual to create a first-time home buyer savings account at a financial institution to pay or reimburse costs for purchase of a single-family residence. The bill requires the account holder to submit transaction information from the savings account to the Department of Revenue on prepared forms during the tax year. The bill specifies actions the financial institution is not responsible, liable, or required to do, and also allows the individual to subtract from their federal taxable income the amount of funds contributed to the savings account. The bill exempts interest or other income on the principal from taxation and allows the account holder to claim subtraction and exemption for the aggregate total of the principal and earnings not exceeding $50,000. The bill specifies withdrawal of the fund for purposes other than purchase of a single-family residence must be included in the account holder's taxable income and requires Department of Revenue to prepare forms and informational materials for the first-time home buyer savings account. The bill applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018, and before January 1st, 2024, and becomes effective 91st day following signee die, and there is a sub-referral to revenue.
Thank you, Madam Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Meek, House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone, and unincorporated Clackamas County. And once again, I am excited here to be in front of you to speak about and introduce House Bill 2996. This bill creates a tool that is key for prospective first-time home buyers to be able to save towards the down payment on their first home. We talked about having assistance. Now this is them putting their own money forward and giving them an opportunity. And so buying a home can seem daunting because it is one of the biggest investment decisions most people make their entire life. Yet it becomes increasingly difficult for working families to pull together an extra buck for that first home. Rising student debt, higher rents are becoming major roadblocks to achieve the American dream. For example, one of the folks that works for me is trying to save up for his first home. And just this last month, he got a $250 rent increase. So that's going to make it another year. You know, it's going to lose $2,000 over this next year that could have gone to his first down payment, but he's paying for rent. So the sooner that we can help folks like that to save money, get out of this situation of instability, and actually do something for themselves, the better off we're going to be. And so House Bill 2996 will allow this individual to open a bank account where deposits and earned interest are exempt from Oregon taxation. Individuals and couples can save up to $50,000 on a 10-year period, during that 10-year period for a down payment. And, you know, as you can see, we don't need that $50,000, but if it's possible, and what I like about this program is that, I don't know, I didn't mention this to this committee, but one of the most exciting and satisfying experiences I've ever had as a realtor was helping one of my first-time home buyers who was 65 years old buy his first house. Can you imagine? He's going to be 95 when he made that last payment. But he didn't care. And, you know, he was able to stabilize himself, bought a nice home, and that was handing those keys over was very exciting. But it took him that long. So this bill offers anybody for a first-time home buyer to start saving at any time in your life. And we all know that sometimes your life starts over at the age of 50 or 53. So you're gonna hear from some of the advocates who can tell you more about the technical aspects of this program. But as a realtor, a homeowner, a father, and an investor, and now a lawmaker, I see the potential to help many Oregonians save for the first time for their home. And I thank you very much, and I welcome any questions, and I also I'm happy to listen to Representative Johnson and his support.
Thank you, Representative. Pleased to be here. Thank you, Madam Chair and co-chairs, or pardon me, vice chairs. For the record, Mark Johnson. I live in Hood River and I represent House District 52. I'm really excited to be able to be a part of this issue. And in fact, I was suggesting early on that it should be called the Millennial Opportunity Act, because I think there really is a generational issue and problem in the state of Oregon. And I can tell you exactly from my perspective, living in the Gorge and living in Hood River especially, the cost of housing is just getting out of sight. For a variety of reasons, not, you know, some of which you are outside of this committee's purview to work on, but you know, entry-level homes are just out of sight of being able to afford for most most folks who are just entering that time in a life when I was able to, my wife and I were able to, you know, put money away, afford a house, and you know, you could get into a house. It cost, I think, our first house was, you know, $50,000+. You know, the place I'm on now, I live on 5 acres. My total mortgage for a 3,000 square foot house plus the cost of land was $76,000. Okay, those days are gone, as we all know, for a variety of factors. But this is an opportunity, I think, to provide a chance and a tool, as my colleague here said, for not just millennials but Oregonians to actually intentionally put aside money for a purpose that's going to be really constructive and helpful for them. And I'll just give you a little anecdote from Hood River County, actually. I'm on the school board, as some of you may know. But, you know, the first day of school this past year, we had literally had a handful of teachers who were living in vans because they could not afford housing in our community. Either it wasn't accessible, it wasn't available, they just couldn't afford the cost. So, again, to put money away in intentional fashion, you know, it'll provide a tool for an intentional investment for the future. So they'll be less tempted, perhaps, to buy that big screen to fritter away on something else that might not be as durable and long-lasting as home ownership. But I think we all would like to be able to have a hand in helping folks to make long-term investments that are good for them, good for our economy, and I think good for our society. So I'm happy to be a part of this, and I think it's a great tool. I would just say it's not unlike the 529 college savings plans that have also been incredibly successful to help folks afford, put away money and save for college expenses, post-secondary, you know, educational expenses as well. So a little different plan, obviously, but it's not unlike that. To save for those things that are most important for you, and as the state, we're just giving them an opportunity and a tool that can make that happen. So happy to answer any questions, and I know there's folks here coming behind us that can explain all the technical aspects.
Good. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have Sean Cleave. Is there anyone else signed up for this? Okay, John Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Cleave representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'd like to thank Representative Meek and Representative Johnson and you too, Madam Chair, for signing on as sponsors for the bill. I don't want to belabor this committee with the positive aspects of home ownership. I think those points have been well made. The impacts on children's performance in school, the ability to build wealth for the middle class, I think those points have been echoed very well in a variety of testimony today. As stated, this is modeled over a 529 plan. Individuals could save over a 10-year period for the purchase of a new home. It is capped at $50,000. I think this is a great incentive to provide individuals a pathway for saving. As you know, probably the best interest rate you could get on a savings account right now is about 1% if you're lucky, not to mention fees and other tools that financial institutions use to help their bottom line. But at as regressive as our Oregon income tax system is in Oregon, it is a powerful incentive to start savings for those purposes. In OLIS, there is an economic analysis that the Oregon Association of Realtors did pay for. That was provided through a grant we got from our national association. It is independent, though. It was provided to us by a firm that has done this modeling for other states. The state of Colorado and the state of Montana have adopted similar programs. In that modeling, the other benefit, aside from home ownership, which this committee, again, is very well aware of, is there is an economic benefit. Of the 3,200 people over a five-year period, we expect to take advantage of this program. The economic activity through either building new homes, I believe the estimate is around 100 new homes would be purchased. The vast majority is purchasing of existing stock, though. There is, when a home is purchased, the economic activity over maybe buying a new couch or buying cleaning equipment equates to about $2,400 in purchasing. That means that jobs are created. We estimate in the short term and long term about 600 jobs created over that five-year period. That creates an opportunity to capture income tax in Oregon. And the program over that same five-year period, as estimated by the study, would cost about $3.6 million. However, there's roughly about $4.6 million in economic activity that would create taxable income. The purchasing of homes also generates the document recording fees. There's a variety of opportunities for capture of income for the state. So very excited about the bill. Happy to answer any questions you might have. One important thing to note, it is very similar to the IDA program. Mm-hmm. That program is capped at 80% AMI. There are some additional benefits with that program, not to mention just the counseling for savings and interacting with a lender. But there, on the IDA program, there is matching funds from nonprofits. I think Representative Sanchez, you're aware of our home foundation that was mentioned earlier in testimony about some of the funds that Oregon Realtors raised for affordable housing. I believe that goes considerably to the IDA. So this really wouldn't be a tool that would take away from the IDA program, but it would probably be utilized by individuals in the 25 to 35 age range. Unfortunately, in 2005, those people, as first-time home buyers, made up around 42%. Currently, we're looking at around 32% of that age group purchasing first-time homes. That is a very important aspect of a healthy housing market. First-time home buyers allow people like me, who have three girls, when we're not playing the Go Fetch a Rock game, we are busy looking at our next opportunity to purchase a house because we're running out of room very quickly. Not enough bathrooms, Madam Chair. And, without an opportunity for somebody to purchase our starter home, we wouldn't have the opportunity to move up to our next. With that, I will close and answer any questions you might have or turn it over to my colleague, to which I think I might have spoke longer than he today.
We'll see.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and yes, you certainly did, Mr. Cleave. We are excited about these pieces of legislation as well, and we're particularly excited in context of the other work this body is doing on housing, getting more supply going, making more opportunities available for people. And a bill of this sort in front of you, obviously from a new home builder standpoint, not a lot of first-time home buyers can be able to buy a new house, but the person that can buy the new house is, like Mr. Cleave indicated, somebody that was able to sell another house, which means more qualified buyers, helps the entire system function, provides opportunity for my folks to build more, and frankly helps society move forward in terms of wealth creation, family stability, neighborhoods, and so on. It's a very good bill. I think it's a great idea. I commend the Realtors for bringing it forward. I wish I'd been smart enough to have the idea in the first place, but I'm happy to provide color commentary, a wholehearted support, and be answered. Turn over any questions to Mr. Cleave.
Any questions from this panel? Is there any means testing at all in this bill?
Madam Chair, there isn't a means test, and I think that is definitely one of the issues that has been raised by the opponents. Again, I think for lower-income Oregonians, the 80% AMI and the other benefits of the IDA program, definitely that would be the pathway for somebody at that income level. Upper-income Oregonians, cash talks. People are going to continue to provide loans or gifts to people on the upper income level. I think that we could test out a variety of hypotheticals on providing means testing in the legislation. I almost see that as more of a hindrance, because the people who would participate in a program like this are people like me. I bought my first house in 2003. I was working at the Assembly. I was a lower level staff and I did not make the income that I needed to provide an incentive for me to save for a down payment. However, at a roughly 7.5% taxable rate, when I calculate my income at that level, that's an incentive that I probably would have been provided to save for my down payment. The option I did have in 2003 was a subprime loan. I hate to admit it, but that's the path I used. I paid for my closing costs, and that was about it. Luckily, I was able to sell that home in 2007. Otherwise, I'd probably still be in it. If you just think of the raw economics of who's going to use this, this is really targeted at young homeowners in their 20s and mid-30s. The economic model is provided in OLIS attached to this bill, teases out some of those hypotheticals.
And one more question, technical question. Can the people who are saving on the IDA make use of this as well? I don't see why not.
I don't see why not. That would be a question I'd want to have a conversation with some of the IDA experts in the back. But again, I think that the hypothetical there would be I would be saving under an IDA program, and then I would also have an additional account that I'd choose to set up. Do I really have the financial ability to do both accounts? And why would I do that when the IDA provides a match from a nonprofit?
Just because they're the piece that they are getting matched, they're getting tripled, their savings piece could then be tax-free. Now, again, they may not have a very high tax. It may not be a very big benefit, but...
Mm. And I believe, Madam Chair, the IDA program is also tax-free.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that piece. Okay. Is that correct? I've seen... Yes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cleave, on this savings account, would somebody outside of the recipient be able to deposit money into those funds, that account?
Chair Kenny Gaia, Representative Meek, that's a good question. Yes, other people would be able to make gifting, that occurs currently to somebody holding the account. There would be no tax benefit whatsoever, though, for those people to provide a gift. So if I were to, remember, this is only for a 10-year period. Hypothetically, if my eldest daughter turned 18 and we were able to afford college with our financial status at that time, hoping that she gets some sort of financial assistance there. I will mention she just did test into the TAG program. Okay. We would take out an account, perhaps, and maybe give an initial gift, and then hope that her salary would build that over time. There would be no benefit to me, though. The benefit would be solely for her. The gift would not count as income for her, though, so which is somewhat similar to a gift letter that's provided for some purchasing of homes.
And people should open their... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, Mrs. Cleave is very intelligent, and
touche.
More than you know.
And for the home buyer, the savings account, a lot of times lenders want to have your funds seasoned, and so getting a gift sometimes makes it difficult to get a gift and to have that money available. So having this account would basically help buyers get into the purchasing process a lot easier also, because they've had this account established, funds have been coming in, so it's another great tool to just really make it.
And the $50,000 would just be capped in terms of the tax credit, but it could exceed $50,000 if other people are gifting it. Is that correct?
No. Madam Chair, the way the bill is drafted is that the account cannot exceed $50,000. Any money that would be deposited into the account above $50,000 would not receive the same tax incentive. Unfortunately, given the median home prices, and especially some members of the committee's districts, $50,000 may not be enough to purchase as a first-time home however, you know, I think for the vast majority of Oregonians, especially those outside of the urban core in Portland, there are a lot of affordable options, and that's really what we're talking about. And that's the reason for the $50,000 caps. And also, it provides some parameters so that the tax incentive doesn't break the bank. But again, at $3.6 million over a five-year period, with the opportunity to recapture income through the economic activity, you know, obviously this body would want our revenue staff to evaluate that. I believe that is occurring currently. It's my hope anyways that it is. But I feel fairly confident based on some of the other information in the IDA program that the numbers look, they just feel right from a gut level.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank
All you. Right. Madam Chair, if I could. So I am very supportive of this bill. In part, it reminds me of the days when we had starter homes. Mm-hmm. They were called, you know, that your first home, and it, you didn't, and then when the economy tanked, I blame part of that on people buying way above their means, yeah, or attempting to get way beyond their means. So it's really, it's sort of nice to see things circle around. And again, I think I as a starter home, it is that really that first step to home ownership and responsibilities and being, you know, contributing members of the society, I guess to say. So thanks for the great work on this one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Guyer, Representative Peluso, you're exactly right. I think one of the major reasons for us dropping 10 percentage points over a 10-year period of the number of first-time home buyers is because the lending market corrected, and people aren't legally aren't allowed to overextend themselves on these types of loans. So you're absolutely right.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For bringing this forward. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2996. And before we adjourn, I wanted to say a couple things about what we're headed into. We have a lot of bills, as you know. I'm trying very hard to hear as many bills as possible and not make a predetermined decision on which ones should be heard and which not. So I tend to want to give them all a chance. That there are some that are being heard on the Senate side, and so we can take those off the docket. There are some that are placeholder bills, so we can take those off the docket. But to the extent possible, trying to let bills get heard in this committee. And as a result, and there's been a lot of interest from people who are not on this committee to try to contribute their ideas to the housing situation, which is fabulous. Mm-hmm. So I know you've all responded to a poll that Cassie sent out asking for various times, and the one that everyone except for Representative Gorsuch can make is April 6th, Thursday night. So we're going to try to do it in a three-hour. Can you not make that
I
one?
Cannot make that one.
Oh, dear.
I didn't want that.
I also cannot.
Well, so
you're going to still have a
did
quorum.
I not take the poll?
We'll still have a
That's
quorum,
not a
and so we're going to go ahead with April 6th because I think that we are having a hard time finding times. We're going to get through as many bills as possible. Probably what I'll aim to do is put more public hearing bills and fewer work and maybe no work, maybe not working any bills, because I'm sure you all want the opportunity to vote on bills. So we'll try to avoid that and put as many work session bills. If you can also try to hold April 13th, if that's a possibility, if we absolutely need something, we're going to try to have all of our public hearings on bills done by April 6th. That only leaves us 3 days, April 11th, 13th, and 18th, to work all of the bills. And you know that we've been holding off a lot of bills, either because the amendments are not ready or because we've been asked, don't move fiscal bills forward. We're going to have to start moving fiscal bills forward because we can't hold off. Representative Olson, would you like to talk about your idea about public hearing / possible work session?
Yeah, honestly, I think we're at a point, Madam Chair, that, and I think everybody here would probably agree to me. If not, then we'll go outside and visit about it. We're at a point now, I think, you know, because of the time, that we need to identify just not a work session, but also possible or not a work session, but a public hearing, but also a possible work session. So that way we, you know, like, be truthful, we had the paperwork today with some of these bills. We can move them today.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So in general, I have tried to avoid that in the interest of democracy and feeling like have a public hearing and give people a chance to, oh, I didn't know that that's what that was about. People who might be listening in. You know, the way I would like to operate is that we have a public hearing always separated from a work session, but we're getting to the point now where we might lose bills if we can't, don't actually have physically the time to work them all. So thank you for spending any additional time so we can really try to do a good due process. But I am going to accept Vice Chair Olson's idea that from now on we start posting things, public hearing / work session. And that's going to mean that it's a little bit more incumbent on you at that point then to read ahead and see if there's things that are very concerning to you. And if they are, please let me know or let the Vice Chair that represents you know so that I don't kind of like, oh, seems like this is fine, and proceed. If you've got some warning bills, when you just either look at the topic or read the bill, you say, hey, I'd really like to hold off a work session on that, I will certainly try to honor that. So, okay. Sometimes we have to just plow ahead. All right. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Human Services. All right. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Human Services.